feeling good out all night. I got the recipe. Wherever I'm cooking is a place to be. Not like obsessively. We'll have a good time on any street. But if you wanna ride with me, gotta find time for the comedy. Have the kind of attitude, a little bit of authenticity. Can't help myself, I'm doing fine. Yeah, I'm feeling good, no, I won't lie.
It's Thursday morning, 11 a.m., time for another episode of CFRC Live Sessions. This week we have local Kingston band Tiny Horse. Tiny Horse are an indie rock group with that sort of 70s folk rock storytelling vibe, but with a distinctly modern indie twist. Tiny Horse are going to be at the Leon Center on New Year's Eve, opening for the Glorious Sons of their New Year's show, so that's pretty exciting. And you can find them on Instagram at Tiny Horse Music, and you can find us on Instagram at CFRC Live Sessions. If you'd like to reach out to tell us about your band or just tell us about the show, you can email us at livesessions@cfrc.ca. The full video of them performing this session for us in Studio A is going to be on YouTube at CFRC Live Sessions. Without further ado, here's Tiny Horse. All right, hi, it's Hayden here with CFRC, and I'm in Studio A here with Tiny Horse. Tiny Horse, how's it going?
Great. Thanks for having us.
Excellent.
Tiny Horse, you guys are here today to play for us. You guys have got this sort of like indie folk sort of singer-songwriter style. I'm not describing it well. How do you guys describe it?
Kira says it best.
Yeah, we describe it a couple ways. Our most recent way we like to describe it is ABBA meets Haim. That's kind of our vibe. So it's like pop, rock. Also, it's Bob Seger meets Taylor Swift in a small town queer bar.
Okay, yes, I think I've seen that description around. And it's a good one. Like, you guys kind of reach across like a spectrum of audiences. Like, you sort of draw in the older small town bar type of crowd and the younger, like, Haim and Taylor Swift sort of thing.
We have a massive following of, like, 5-year-olds and also 65-year-olds, I would say. If we had a chart, it looks like a hammock.
It's very extreme.
Yeah.
Those are two kind of moneymaker audiences.
Totally. Cash.
And when you mentioned the Haim thing, like when you guys are playing, you hear a lot, the three of you kind of harmonizing all the way across. And I wanted to ask you guys, like, how do you go about, when you were forming this band, how do you go about finding people that you have that kind of like musical chemistry with that you can sort of just snap into that mode?
Well, Julia is my sister's best friend.
Yes.
I'm like, how do...
So
how
we let her in it? Because of that.
It was... Julia and I have known each other forever. And Ray and I have known each other forever.
Forever? Yeah. And then me and Harvey have also... Yeah, we were in a forever. Band previous to this band. And we also worked together. So yeah. When we were looking for a drummer, I mean, Harvey was our number one pick.
King's just looking close to home.
Yeah. That helps.
And it was, it started as Ray and I, it started as like a boring little twosy, and then we needed to, you know,
beef it
sex
up a
sells,
bit.
We had to add something to the mix, so yeah. We added these two in.
So we got Harvey.
Yes, got Harvey. You did.
Yeah. But yeah, I think we were mostly just looking for people that we like to hang out with, because we obviously spend a lot of time together, and that were super talented. Couldn't name a single musical note, and Julia knows every key there ever was, and so we kind of had like our musical rooting.
Yeah, so then, we have like the extreme like great musicians over on this side, and then we have me and Kira on this side who don't know what we're doing, but
we can write the songs,
but founded the band. Yeah. So you get to pick. Yeah. Who's in it and
so they can stay.
Yeah.
You guys always say that too. You know, we're the musicians and you're that. But no, it got me into it at the beginning was just hearing how easy it was to all mesh together. Like when we first started playing, I could already hear what I wanted to play, and it's been pretty seamless.
And let's talk about writing the songs. Like, do you two do still most of the writing, or is it sort of like a broad collaborative process?
Yeah, it's pretty much, it starts, most of the ideas start with me and Kira, and we try to write, we usually just like hash out a full song, and then we bring it to these guys. But we have like, there's been times, like 1%, for instance, Julia brought the idea forth, and then we kind of rolled with it.
She stumbled into a rehearsal very burnt out and stressed out, singing, "I'm at 1% high." And it was more like a yodel than a song, I would say. But she's singing it, and we're like, "That's sick. Like,
Something's there.
Something's there for sure."
And yeah. It was kind of an important rehearsal because we were like going into recording. So we were supposed to be focusing. And then we're just like, "No, we got to write this song. Like, this
whatever
is,
that is.
Whatever that is lands." So yeah, it's at 1% was definitely, it came from Julia's
life.
Julia's life.
Life in Charles, in the best way though. Who hasn't been there, you know? Who hasn't felt that way?
And that's your newest song, right? 1%. You guys just put that out just pretty recently.
Yeah, we put that song out way back in November now. So we've had two other songs come out since then. Hayden, catch up, come right on. And, but yeah, that's definitely one of the newer songs that we have that's come out.
And you just came up with that riff, that little vocal out of nowhere?
Yeah, it wasn't a full song by any means when I brought it to the group, but I have two little kids at home, and I was like at my wit's end, and I just had my guitar out, and it just happened, that little la-da-da-da-da-da. And then we just built it up from there.
It was also, you came to that song like right after Sinead O'Connor had died. So it was like, I feel like a lot of Sinead was playing and that mm-hmm. kind of like, you know, Kate Bush not scared to kind of go up
the
and
vocal
down.
Vocal flips.
That was coming in.
Yeah.
Or that's what we were listening to a lot of. So I think that there is kind of some of that in the song. Julia's also, she's not just a mom. She's notoriously has ill. Bad luck and she's chronically ill. So it's kind of an amalgamation of, I think that song is great for a lot of people because like we find like a lot of people just like with bad luck or feeling burnt out or feeling tired or, and anyway, it relates to a lot of different people because Julia touches on all those tricky
fit
parts
all the
of
categories.
Life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks for being here today.
Yeah.
what does a 1% moment look like for the rest of you three?
Oh, good question. Who I need, come back to me.
Don't look at me.
It's like, 1% is like one of those nights where you don't sleep a single wink, and then you go in to work or something, and
you're putting your mascara on in the car. You know, you're like, there's just no time.
There's stains on your pants.
You're a week behind in everything you want to be in.
Yeah, you're crying and have to go into a Zoom meeting.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's 1%.
That is 1%.
Or like you open your fridge and there's nothing there and you're starving and you're poor and you can't order Mary Brown's Uber Eats because it costs $25. That's 1%.
Perfect. Well, let's get into the music.
Yeah.
What's the first song we're going to hear from you guys today?
The first song is the JP special, John Player special to be exact.
Tell us a little about that one.
Yeah, it's kind of a quirky song. I hate to use that word, but I feel like that makes sense. It started as kind of like a piano and drums kind of song. And then we brought in the electric guitar. And
the song is sort of everything, everywhere, all at once. Like it's about a lot of different things kind of meeting together in this quiet moment of what it means to be a radio star.
Wow, nicely said.
Let's hear it.
Of what they might say. Don't take the John Player special lightly. Don't get caught stealing all her lightning.
I wore that shirt every day.
I think that you were made for me. I'm Toto, you can be my Dorothy. You still dream of America, America. We don't go there anymore. You fly free, butterfly, butterfly. Don't go knocking at my door. It's me, I'm a radio star, and I'm gonna love you just the way that you are. You said, hey, it's me, I'm a radio star, and I'm gonna love you just the way that you, the way that you are. Sleeping all day.
Don't rush me, you can be annoying.
I stayed up till 4 in the morning. I made every mistake.
Seems like the time is always fleeting.
It's getting late, baby, we should be leaving.
You still dream of America, America. We don't go there anymore. It's me, I'm a radio star.
Radio star.
And I'm gonna love you just the way that you are. You said, hey, it's me, I'm a radio star. And I'm gonna love you just the way that you, the way that you are.
We're back with Tiny Horse in Studio A, and we talked a little bit just there about your guys' writing process, but let's get into how you guys record your songs. And I barely even need to ask you about this, because on your Instagram, you're pretty public with your like recording process and everything. What inspires you to like be so forthcoming about what your guys' process is for putting these songs together? Because not too many bands are posting like full in-depth recording documentaries like that.
Yeah, we're full on narcissists. We're just like, they gotta know.
I think it's just part of like the music scene today. You kind of have to just be on social media at all times. Like, that's just what you have to do, like, stay relevant and, you know, keep putting out content. So that's kind of what we tried to do, and just stay on top of things and post things that are like kind of fun. We try to make it fun.
I think also there's like a lot of mystery behind music. Like, a lot of people don't know like how much time it takes to make one song or how much it costs. So I feel like a lot of people right now, we're sitting on a bunch of songs. If you were to come to our show, we can play like 18 songs. But if you go on our Spotify, there's only like two that are professionally recorded. So I think sometimes we do it to kind of explain just why it takes so long, and kind of why paying for a ticket or buying the merch really sort of like helps actually have these songs come to life.
It has like real world results, like when people support small music like that.
Yeah, because people want to know, and like people want to know that to do it, because we're definitely like going into our recording process wanting to do it like really properly. So we're paying like professional engineers, producers, mixers, and masters. And like that obviously costs money. because people are putting a lot of time into it, right? So I think that's why we do it.
And even like our friends and family, like we had our families come out to the studio when we were recording, and like even the people that are closest to us sometimes don't even really know what goes on behind the scenes, so it's nice for them to be able to see what happens and just what we're doing when we're there.
Mm-hmm. Right. And speaking of people that you work with when you're recording your music, you guys have done some work with Brett, is that correct, from Glorious Sons?
Yeah, Brett Emmons, he's been helping us a lot.
He's our fairy godmother.
He is our fairy godmother. He makes our dreams come true.
What does that look like, a studio day with Brett involved?
So we record, we have done two sessions out at his house, which is out on Buck Lake.
Don't disclose that.
I know. Should I tell them how to get there? But anyway, it's like this nice like wood big house. So we have a sound engineer that comes in there. And we'll,
Steve.
He's so cute.
Shout out, Steve.
And talented and thoughtful. But normally we'll show up. We spend the first kind of day getting everything sort of toned in and setting up the microphones. And we've always start with Harvey and bass to kind of like lay down the tracks. And then what does a day look like with Brett though? Like,
we get there at like 11 o'clock.
There's a lot of barking dogs.
There's a lot of smoking cigarettes,
yeah,
and drinking coffee.
Yeah.
Coors Lights
just flowing like wine.
He's got some really creative production ideas too, though, that, you know, like we'll come with a song fully finished, ready to record. And then he gets in the moment and he's like, what if you put this weird, like, squealing lampshade if you hit it with this, and you're like, what would that sound like? And he's just really creative and unique with his kind of finishing touches.
Yeah, he just had like a curiosity to all of our songs, I felt like, and was like respectful of like how he wanted them to be structured, but was still always up with new ideas for like each track as we were working through it, and some of them worked out really, really well.
Yeah, I love hearing about somebody that sort of like pushes you in a direction that no member of the band does. Like, that's kind of the value in having like an outside person. I don't know if you guys use the word mentor or something like that, but an outside person that helps you out.
That's cute.
Yeah,
and also we're such a live band that like we've played some of these songs we've played for like years at this point live, and then to imagine it recorded, like the recorded version of it, has to be different. Mm-hmm. But we've played it so many times that it's almost hard to be like to change it. So I think that having that outside perspective.
And it's rocks. Not like they're huge changes. It's just like little subtle chord changes.
It's minors. We don't know how to do minor chords, so we got to add in minor chords. And
helped us with harmonies as well.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet. So what's the second song we're going to hear from you guys today?
At 1%.
Okay, let's hear it. We already know about this song, so let's hear it.
Chica.
Telling white lies every night.
Every night.
Hands up if you're not doing something that you like.
Not one to notice you stopped growing, so did I. Good news and bad news can't be the same. Losing. I'm done with hearing I'm not right. It's so confusing. Oh God, I hate what it feels like. I'm a 1% type. Never been so tired when the tank is empty. Would you come and get me? I'm a 1% type. Think I just might die when the world is ending. Would you just forget me?
I'm a strike. You're hanging roses on the line.
Every night.
Your emasculation, my frustrations, they collide.
Hey,
confusing. Oh God, I hate what it feels like. I'm at 1% tired. Never been so tired when the tank is empty. Would you come and get me? I'm at 1% tired. Think I just might die when the world is ending. Would you just forget me? I'm at 1% tired. Never been so tired when the tank is empty. Would you come and get me? I'm at 1% tired. Think I just might die when the world is empty. Would you come and get me? I'm at 1% tired. Never been so tired. I'm getting through it. I'm getting through it. I'm at 1% tired. I just might die, but I'm getting away. Would you come and get me, get me?
And we're back in CFRC Studio A with Tiny Horse. That was their song 1%, which is off their new upcoming studio album, debut studio album. Let's talk about that, guys. What's the road looked like so far for making that album?
Well, we started recording it last March, and we did it over the two sessions, obviously, with Brett. And It's seven tracks, so that's an album. We're calling it an album. It's good. It's great. We're really happy about it. And I think it was amazing kind of like making this album over the past year, and then obviously New Year's Eve was such like an amazing time to like celebrate playing so many of the songs from it, and we got like such a great response, and we're really excited kind of heading into this new year with like the full, you know, full piece that people can actually listen to as like a full collection, and having a full band representation of who we are. So we're super stoked on it.
It's like, I mean, they call it the debut album, but it's like your real, real entrance to like sort of the music world as a band. I mean, like, not that you're not a band until you have an album, but you get what I'm saying. I mean, it's kind of like the piece that people look towards.
Yeah, it's so cliche, but it's like you spend your whole life making your first album. And I've never put out an album. Kira's never put out an album. I mean,
I haven't put out a whole album.
But like, this feels so, like, for me at least, it just like feels like I'm finally making the music that I want to make. And I'm like so proud of these songs and just where we've come in such like a short amount of time. So finally getting like an album together is like so huge and exciting.
Is the anticipation, do you feel like the anticipation for you guys has been just continuously building this whole time? Like, I mean, when you first start talking about an album versus when you're right at the end of completing it, like what's that sort of buzz feel like for you guys?
God, it's long. It's like the so longest, long. Slowest process of all time. Like And it's got so many like highs. Like you'll have all these amazing shows or you'll release a single and you'll be so stoked about it. But then there's so much kind of time in between. And I think that one thing that we've done really well is that we've done it exactly how we wanted to do it. And taking our time was kind of part of that. But it feels really exciting now that it's actually...
things are moving.
Coming out, and...
we actually have the songs, and we're like getting all the masters back, and everything sounds the way that we actually wanted it to sound like, which is so crazy, because for so long, we both... well, I've recorded so many times, and it's not all, it doesn't always go the way that you want. You're not always happy with how it sounds. And working with Brett and Steve, they really captured our sound, and like they got exactly what we were trying to do, and they shared our vision and just made it happen. Like all together, we made it happen. They helped us make it happen. But it's just, I don't know. It doesn't really feel real yet.
That's sweet. And then I don't even know if you guys are projecting this far ahead right now, but what does the roadmap for Tiny Horse look like post-album?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely have like very high hopes for the summertime, and we've applied to every festival ever. But we had a really great summer last year. We had the opportunity to play Hillside Festival, which was really cool. And we're optimistic that we're going to lock down a couple more of those really fun folk festivals. Winnipeg folk, if you're watching this, please let us come. And Mariposa, we'd love to do that too. But a really big sort of summer festival season. And then we're also going to be doing some Ontario dates, kind of touring, like a headlining tour for us in the next couple weeks. So keep an eye out.
Sweet. It sounds like there's lots to keep track of when it comes to Tiny Horse. Where can people look to find you guys?
If you go to Spotify or iTunes or YouTube, any of the major platforms, you can check out our music. We're on Instagram and Facebook and where else?
Yeah, check us out on our Instagram. Is, I would say that's our strongest, our strongest platform. Check us out on Instagram, and we have a website. If you want to see where we're playing, go to our website. Give us a Google. Don't YouTube Tiny Horse, though.
You will get SNL.
You will get Timothy Chalamet on SNL.
Yeah. Sweet. All right. What's our last song that we're going to hear from you guys today?
Last song we're going to have is Don't Go.
And what is this song? What's this song about?
Not going.
Don't do it.
Don't Go is kind of like a, it's like a plea with someone. It's kind of like a breakup song, or kind of like a, just one of those moments when you're with someone and you can't, you're trying to see eye to eye, and you're just missing each other somehow.
All right, let's hear it.
In a long time, I try to shake it off, but I don't know why. I can't even look at you, I can't even look in the mirror so clear. I can't make you understand, I can't make you stay here. Don't go. Shaking like it's a fault line. My fault, your choice.
Like I ever had a choice.
But if we're gonna do this, babe, you gotta get out of your own way. Worst case, it all goes wrong. Don't go, don't go. If you gotta go, you gotta go. You can't taste it. And it might be okay, or it turns out we both hate it. For you I ride the other line, cold and wasted. I hope you know.
Don't go. If you gotta go,
gotta go, you gotta go. Don't go, don't go.
Horse. And you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Today on Wings, a spirituality of solstice.
Celebrate the birth of the sun. Light the way, O Lucina. Dance around on Sabbath night. Blessed be the great mother.
Celebrate the birth of the sun. By the way, O Lucina. Dance around on Sabbath night. Blessed be the great mother. Celebrate the birth of the sun.
This Lucina chant is sung by Ruth Rhiannon Barrett, an elder Dianic priestess, on her album The Year is a Dancing Woman. Lucina is one of many names used for the goddess Diana. The song refers to an event that we in the Northern Hemisphere will soon experience again, the winter solstice. I'm Frieda Worden. From my audio studio in Canada, I see the sunset move daily farther south, and the hours of light decline sharply each day. Around December 21st, the process is going to pause. That's the solstice. Then justice gradually reverse. Various religions hold festivals of light in winter, but I wanted to hear from one that retains a connection to solstice. My friend Letitia Layson and her friend Holin Kennan were both ordained by Ruth Barrett as priestesses in Dianic Wicca, a registered religion in the United States. One woman is now in Wisconsin and one in Texas. We chatted on Zoom.
This happens to be the 50th anniversary of the Dianic tradition, which began on winter solstice in 1971. My name is Letitia Layson. I have been ordained in three goddess traditions. The one that I'm going to be representing today is the Dianic tradition. I was ordained as a Dianic high priestess in the Zee Budapest line.
I'm Holin Kennan. I'm also called Holin Black Moon. Like Letitia, I am also a Dianic high priestess ordained in the Zee Budapest lineage. And Letitia and I met each other in Los Angeles many, many, many years ago, and both practiced together for many, many, many years.
Wow. So you both say that you're in the Zee Budapest tradition. Who is Zee Budapest?
In 1971, Zee Budapest, who was an immigrant from Hungary and an ardent feminist, according to Zee, she realized that feminism needed a spiritual component to it. And Zee began to bring elements of Wicca, the craft, and her mother's folk tradition together and offered that to the women of the Los Angeles area. And that's how the Dianic tradition started back in 1971.
And it did become an international phenomenon. Once she published her book, she was brought all over the world. And this year, Zee's book will be coming out again in print.
So what's the meaning of Dianic?
The goddess Diana originated in Italy, and she is also known in the Greek traditions as Artemis. Diana in Italy is the goddess of the moon. And her daughter, Aradia, is considered to be the first avatar who actually came into physical form to teach the mysteries of her mother, the goddess Diana, the mysteries of the moon, to the women. So Holland and I actually met at Circle of Aradia in Los Angeles in the early 90s.
Now, I have a couple of questions about that. First, how do you spell Aradia?
A-R-A-D-I-A.
And what was the meaning of avatar at that time? Because now it's something on the internet.
Yes, avatar. She uses that as a reference to spirit into matter. So it really is a goddess who is embodied in physical form.
So in this Dianic form of Wicca, is there an orthodoxy?
No, actually, it's pretty unorthodox. It ranges very widely. Z's original Holy Book of Women's Mysteries sourced its form from both Italian witchcraft and the traditions of Rome and those festivals, and then also brought in a couple of other existing witch traditions like Gardnerian and Alexandrian. But having said that, from Z's original Holy Book of Women's Mysteries, women have added their own skills and their own perspectives to make it rounder and sometimes very particular to a particular locale where the tradition is being practiced. There is a similarity of practice while it's not formalized that you must do the following things in the following way.
But Z's lineage specifically emerges from Z's work, and she does the festivals from Greece, Thesmorphia and
Stenia. I like Stenia. Stenia is the bitching festival, which I think is awesome because it's women sitting around and just having their say and venting, which is really something we don't get to do. And then the Thesmophoria is it's the cycle with Demeter and Persephone. Demeter being the mother of the harvest, and then Persephone being her daughter who descends and emerges from the underworld.
So what do you think is the fundamental, the earthly basis of all these different practices?
Well, I would say it is the earth itself and the way the earth relates to the cosmos. Pagan traditions and Wiccan traditions in general are earth-based, meaning that we cycle with the seasons. And the seasons are related to the way in which the sun and the moon actually travel around the earth.
So at winter solstice, what we're dealing with, if you're in a small village or a small community, is you've done the last of your harvest by Halloween, by a Samhain, and you've got a few things left over, maybe some apples and a few other things, and now it's about to go into the dead of winter. It's the shortest night, but it's going to get much colder. And so it's a moment to pause and reflect, and an awareness and a connection to the fact that the light will eventually return. So we have faith in that happening. And what we do at winter solstice is decorate and sing and gather to celebrate the returning light within the moment of the darkest night.
One of the things in the Dianic tradition that is very different than other Wiccan traditions is that we honor the mysteries of the female, focused on the goddess and maternal values or mother values. The Dianic tradition looks at the world through a lens of creation in this birthing metaphor that reflects itself on the earth in the agricultural cycles. And winter solstice is the season in which the sacred child is honored.
Ruth Barrett, who was the high priestess who ordained Letitia and me, talks about winter solstice as the quickening. So it's not the actual birth, which is what happens in a lot of other spiritual traditions, including Christianity. It's the awareness of the new life that will be born, that awareness that there is a shift, but it is not the birth itself, not yet.
This is a little bit side question, but I thought I'd ask it before I forget, and that is, how is this practiced in the Southern Hemisphere?
Well, we'd have to ask them, because the Earth actually travels around 365 days approximately to go around the sun itself, but it also tilts. It tilts away from the sun when it's winter, and when it's summer, we tilt towards the sun. So here we are in the north, we have the shortest day, and that's why the Southern Hemisphere has the longest day. They are experiencing summer solstice.
So they really shouldn't be celebrating Christmas now either. They should be celebrating it in June.
Well, Christmas is a Christian holiday that's based on a solar calendar or the Gregorian calendar. So December 25th, they would celebrate the birth of Christ. But if you're celebrating Father Winter, you would celebrate that in the cold season for the Southern Hemisphere.
Now I want to hear about your own experiences with this religion. Is it fair to call it a religion?
It isn't necessarily true that all Dianics identify their practice in the old traditions as a religion. It predates religion. So some of these women who practice in circles or covens and also as solitaires might identify their Dianic practice as a spirituality, not necessarily a religion. We do, however, when you were asking us, we practice our faith as a religion, for sure. We have holy days that we honor together. We have rites of passage, or we have sacraments that we would identify as things that we do. And with the holy days, we have what would be considered liturgy and even a creation story.
Ooh, let's hear a little creation story.
Well, you're in the right season for that. Holland, would you like to talk about that?
Sure. This is the quickening, and then the goddess is born, usually around February 1st, and then she becomes a girl child. This is a reflection of a woman's life cycle. So she grows up, and in May, she experiences her menses, her menstrual period for the first time. And then as the year rolls around in June, at the summer solstice, she becomes a mother, or at least a creatrix, not necessarily biologically a mother, although if we're following a life cycle, a body cycle, then she at least has the potential to become a mother. And then as the seasons go on further, she becomes, some people will call it a queen, which I think is kind of a loaded word, but she becomes a woman who is present in her own right. Her children, if she has any, may have gone, and she is experiencing herself to the fullest. And then at autumn equinox in September, she becomes an elder. At Hallows, she becomes what is called a crone, a much older elder, over 60, what is it, Letitia, 59, 60, whatever, 62. And then the mystery part is right now, begins right now at the winter solstice, where she is beginning the cycle of dying and of being born, or potentially being born at the same time. So this is one of the mystery hinges, that moment between the light being gone completely and then the light coming back. This is a mystery tradition, and that's one of them. The goddess does not die and disappear. She reappears every year.
On Wings, Dianic High Priestesses Letitia Layson and Holland Kennan are telling about their religion and its connection to winter solstice, which happens in the Northern Hemisphere around December 21st.
So what attracted each of you to this religion?
Holland started before I did, so I would like Holland to begin.
I'd been a witch since I was 15. It found me. I didn't find it, but that was back in the 70s when you didn't have a lot of access to information. And so I practiced solitary for many, many years. And then I took a class with Ruth Barrett called Our Sacred Bloods, and it was about these exact mysteries that I've just mentioned of this woman's life cycle, and it was life-shaking. And so I began to do rituals with Circle of Aradhya, and then also took training outside of Circle of Aradhya with what's called a family traditionalist. Her background was in English and German Wicca. And then Letitia found me again at an event called Long Beach Woman Spirit and said, we need you back at Circle, or you should come to Circle of Aradhya. And so I did. And so that's how I got involved.
You said it found you. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Sure. I had always been drawn to folk traditions and what people would call magic. So it's connecting with nature, of plants, animals, the seasons, the sky, and you connect with that, and then you you could transform your world, and you can transform it internally, and you can transform it externally. And so I lived on a mountain, and so those things were accessible to me all the time, and I didn't think of it as being something unusual until I got into my 20s, and then I realized not everybody did that.
I actually thought I was going to a drumming and dance circle, and a women's empowerment drumming and dance circle. And it ended up being the very first goddess-dedicated dance circle that the facilitator had. And as it turned out, many of the women had been trained in the Dianic tradition, so it was ritualistic. The teachings were based on images Maria Gambutas found embodying the original snake bird goddess, the original primordial expression going back 30,000 years. And the women in that circle were Dianics, trained at Circle of Aradhya. And so I sort of happened into it. I was interested in drumming and dance and ritual, and that's how it started. So I think the first event that I went to was in a fall equinox. Then I took my first class in October and then facilitated my first public ritual at winter solstice. So it was within the first 3 months that I began to be in service to the community. Yeah.
I didn't realize that. I started similarly, and I think it was by the third ritual that we were doing ritual drumming.
Well, Letitia, you mentioned that you were trained in a couple of other traditions. How did that happen?
Well, each of these things had a very personal expansion. The woman who facilitated the dance circle had her own tradition, and it was goddess-based and ritual-based, but the core of it wasn't Wiccan. She identified the work specifically as shamanic, kind of shamanic dance, and it was a healing tradition. And then I went to Circle of Aradhya, and the Circle of Aradhya was both individual and group oriented. And then the Fellowship of Isis was international and eclectic. So the Fellowship of Isis is another goddess tradition. Isis is the Greco-Roman name for the Egyptian goddess Auset, or Ast, A-S-T. So she's an African, North African, that's Egypt, is North African goddess. And they don't celebrate the equinoxes and the solstices. In Egypt, they would celebrate the inundation of the Nile. And in fact, the Isian mysteries are focalized around Osiris, Isis, Osiris, Nephthys, and Set were the original beings who were embodied. They were the first fully formed human gods that were depicted. And Osiris is the original dying king. He's the year king. He's constantly dying, and his wife and sister Isis continues to bring him back to life. So in that tradition, there's a goddess and god.
Huh.
Our
particular ICEUM, this group that we had, was unique because it was women only. Most of the women had been trained by other women. Many of them had been trained in the Dianic tradition. And we would have public rituals on the beach that would be between 80 and 125 people on the beach. And Circle of Aradia would have, when Holland and I were attending at that time with Ruth, between 80 and 180 women, our largest being 250 women when we would have large festivals.
Mm-hmm. I want to mention that in the Dianic tradition, it's not confined to the goddess Diana. There is a recognition of goddesses actually throughout the world. So there's a recognition and an honoring of female divinity as the goddess expresses herself everywhere. So it's not just Diana that we are connected with. It can be Isis, it can be Demeter or Persephone or Frau Holda or Freya or Amaterasu in Japan. All of them are honored.
In the very beginning of Z's book, there is a dedication to She of 10,000 Names. So She of 10,000 Names is who we speak about, and each of the faces of the goddess is a facet, the way in which the people have seen a reflection of divinity that is goddess on their land. So that's the way that we recognize that she has been here always and is reflected on all the lands.
The last thing I think that I want to ask is about how solstice is celebrated and how you would celebrate it in a city, how you would celebrate it on the land.
Lots of light, lots of candles. When we look at our current Christmas celebrations, those shiny balls are mirrors to attract the sun. Our decorations of fruit and sun ornaments, all of those things, oranges as a symbol of the sun. So all of those things that remind us of light, that bring back light as a connection to the sun that will emerge, is part of what would be going on the land. They also do something called wassailing the apple trees, where they take a good drink of, it's got ale and it's got spices and so on, and you go out and you sprinkle it around the apple trees, asking them to bear fruit for the next years. And then you drink a bunch yourself. So that's part of what we do on the land.
I'll speak about the way in a city, because Circle of Aradia was in Los Angeles. And part of our commitment to the women who were urban was to educate them about the dark and that we were in the dark season. So part of what we do is extinguish all the light so that women can feel comfortable in the dark. So the room is completely pitch black at the height of our ritual, so that women can understand that we don't need to be afraid of the dark, that it's in the darkness of the womb of the goddess, in the darkness of the earth, that life begins. And the quickening happens inside the darkness. So we are comfortable in that place of the dark. And then the light gradually comes. And it isn't because there's light or that we have some kind of false hope. We are actually celebrating the promise of the light coming, and we dance to awaken the earth from its winter sleep and to help agitate the earth to bring the warmth back. That's part of what we do. So our rituals involve dancing and storytelling. And it's also the time in our particular community, because of the way that our mysteries are overlaid on the seasons, it is the time that new children who were born in the last solar cycle are blessed and introduced to the community. So we honor the spirit child, and the mothers and children are processed around and recognized and honored.
Anything else?
People can get outside and just experience a bit of dark assuming that they're in the Northern Hemisphere, a bit of dark, a bit of cold, find, you know, gaze on an evergreen tree. That was one of the symbols of the season because it did not die. Just experience that dark point and know that we're connected to the sun, to the land, to the emergence of life again. We're not separate from it. That would be a good practice to do. Simple. Go inside maybe and light a candle in remembrance of that.
This is also the season where we're together in community, because in the Northern Hemisphere, it's cold. So we come together and we feast and we celebrate and we say our formal gratitudes for the last solar cycle, honoring all of the joys and sorrows. But we end with the celebration of gratitude and bring that into the light. Our tradition really is for the health of women and our reflection on the earth. And that's one of the reasons why I was very attracted to this tradition. Until the power of balance has shifted, you know, generally speaking, my work is focused with women, as you can see.
So Labha Fana is analogous in a really wonderful way to Santa Claus. And she is a grandmother, and one of her symbols is a chicken, a hen. And she has a bag filled with goodies. And so she is Italian and is a gift giver. And that's part of the tradition at this season, is to give gifts sometimes. You know, oranges are very popular here in Wisconsin. I didn't appreciate them until I moved here. Coming from Southern California, they were just there. But she brings all kinds of lovely things to the children, just as Santa Claus does. So we even have female gift givers. Another interesting goddess of the season that I'm particularly connected to is Mother Berchta, also or called Frau Holda, and I spin wool. And during the 12 days of Christmas, which was probably, you know, before Christmas, it was slightly different, you may not spin. No wheels can turn. So I must stop my spinning of wool for 12 days, which is very difficult, and my wheel stays silent and still until that period passes where I can spin again. And this allows Frau Holda and Mother Berchta to do their work of bringing in the season. And they, you know, and so I have to pause in the dark. I can do nothing that are my accustomed tasks because it's winter solstice. I must be still.
Stopping. That's a good tradition.
Yes. Yes.
The gardens are quiet. You know, we put our garlic in. We've put everything to bed that we can. We've harvested everything we can. It's down in storage. And now is the point of stillness when you have your family and your food gathered together and you wait. And you wait. And that's okay. The waiting is fine because it gives you strength to go into the new year. When the plants start coming up, it's going to get very, very busy. So this is a time to recharge and renew because you're still, you are at rest. There is little work to be done out on the land. So you can attend to other smaller things that are important.
Wings thanks our guests, Dianic High Priestesses Letitia Layson and Holin Kennan. Also, thanks to maternalgifteconomymovement.org and their Zoom technician, Diane Wiedenkopf, and your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning, and editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The music was Lucina Chant, sung by Ruth Rhiannon Barrett and composed by Kay Gardner, recorded on The Year is a Dancing Woman, Part 1.
Celebrate the birth of the sun. Light the way, O Lucina. Dance around on Sabbath night. Blessed be the great mother.
Celebrate the birth of the sun.
Light the way, O Lucina.